The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, by Robert A. Caro, Part 2, Continued. In obtaining and filling patronage positions, Lyndon Johnson worked very hard. In no field were his energy and his willingness to do whatever was necessary to achieve a goal more evident. Hearing that a job, federal, state, or county, was opening up, he would spend hours on the telephone talking to men who might be willing to make another telephone call to the official in charge of hiring someone to fill the job, and who might be willing to ask the official to give it to someone recommended by Dick Clayburgh's secretary. The 400-mile round trip to save the Education Department position for Kellum was not the only long drive he took in Texas when he felt that his personal appearance might give him a say in the disposition of a job. This work was very important to him. Latimer was with him when he received Kellum's call telling him that the superintendent of education was reneging. Hanging up, Johnson shouted as he headed for his car, "We can't let him get away with that!" And, Latimer says, the chief was very, very upset. Patronage was very important to him. I remember hearing Lyndon say that this business of getting these people jobs is really the nucleus of a political organization for the future, Russell Brown says. In his attempts to obtain patronage, he did not, the secretary to an obscure congressman, have much ammunition to work with. So he could not afford to let any opening slip away. And his work paid off. A network had sprung up, a network of men linked by an acquaintance with Lyndon Johnson, who were willing, because of Lyndon Johnson, to help one another. Johnson had few jobs at his disposal. If one of them was vacated by the friend for whom he had obtained it, he wanted it to be passed on to another friend. White Star Deason's acquiescence to Johnson's insistence that he not return to Alamo Heights High School meant that a job would be vacant there when school reopened in September 1934. Deason did not notify the school of his change of heart until the very day that classes began in September. And it had been arranged that at the very moment Deason was telephoning a school official to tell him he needed a new teacher was actually standing in the official's office, application in hand. White Star, Horace Richards, who was quickly hired. "We always passed jobs on this way," Deason says. Johnson, in fact, had passed on his own. Leaving Sam Johnson High School to become Clayburgh's secretary, he had persuaded school officials, in somewhat of a quandary because of the suddenness of his departure, to hire Hollis Frazier, college debater and White Star, to replace him as debate coach. Frazier, at Johnson's suggestion, later passed on the job to White Star Bert Horn. Richards passed on his to White Star Buster Brown. Among the significant aspects of this network was its location. More and more of the jobs Johnson was obtaining now were in Texas, all across Texas. Clayburgh's secretary had parlayed Clayburgh's friendship with Myers of the Federal Land Bank into a friendship for himself with the head of the Land Bank's Houston office. That office was to hire 294 appraisers and attorneys in the first 2 years after its establishment in 1933. Among them would be Ben Crider, Bill Deason, Sam Houston Johnson, and a dozen other men hired on Johnson's recommendation. Also in Houston, of course, were Sam Houston High and Hollis Frazier. In San Antonio there were Horace Richards and Buster Brown, and Dan Quill and his post office jobs. In Austin there were Jesse Kellum, and when the Federal Housing Administration opened a branch office there, an appraiser or two. And in Corpus Christi, and in many of the little towns of the 14th Congressional District, there were postmasters and rural mail carriers, and WPA and CCC employees. Houston, San Antonio, Austin, Corpus Christi. The network was beginning to cover a significant part of Texas. It was not a political organization. Its members were far too few to justify that title. It was, however, what Lyndon Johnson said it was, the nucleus of a political organization. Thanks to his skill in distributing the meager resources he possessed, the skill with which he had selected the recipients of his precious jobs, those jobs were held by men bound, by gratitude, by ambition, by love, to a single leader, even though that leader was still only a young congressional aide. They were men he could count on. The road he saw before him, the road to the dim, vast ambition about which he never spoke, was a very long road. Though its general direction, elective office, had become clear, he still couldn't see its turnings, still didn't know which of many paths he would follow. But now, as a result of his genius in distributing jobs, he could be sure that whatever the paths he chose, he would not be without assistance when he trod them. As a far-seeing and determined explorer caches hidden supplies along a route he knows he will follow in years to come, so that they will be waiting for him when he needs them, Lyndon Johnson had cached along his route the resource indispensable to his plans, men. These men were hidden now, low-level aides in nooks and crannies of large bureaucracies. But they were ready to march at his command. When he needed them, he would be able to call them, and they would come. Geography had always been a barrier to the ambitions of Texas politicians. The state's vastness, coupled with its division into 254 counties, many more than any other state, each with its own independent political organization, and coupled also with the strict constitutional limits placed on governmental powers by a citizenry notably distrustful of government, had blocked efforts to achieve statewide political power. During the 90 years since Texas had become a state, only Jim Ferguson had been able to form an organization responsive in all corners of Texas to the command of a single individual. In 90 years, only one statewide political organization had been created by this immensely powerful and resourceful governor. Another was being created now, by a congressional aide, one of 1,000 congressional aides, not yet 27 years old. He tried to arrange his trips back and forth to Texas so that he drove with Clayburgh or another congressman rather than with his assistants. He wanted to go with someone up, not someone down, Latimer explains. But sometimes he had no choice but to make the 3-day journeys with the two youths with whom, representing Sam Houston High, he had already spent so much time in a car. Latimer and Jones dreaded these trips. Their chief drove a car as he drove them. "He drove to the limit of the car's ability," Jones says. "If it would go 80, he would go 80. Roaring up behind a slower-moving vehicle, he would honk the horn wildly to make it pull over so that he could pass. He drove like a crazy man," Jones says. If one of them was at the wheel, his concern for his own physical well-being, always so noticeable, was manifested by constant nervous criticism. As Latimer came up behind another car, Johnson would reach in front of him to push viciously down on the horn while shouting, "Get on around, Gene, you're going to kill us." Adding to the unpleasantness of these trips was another aspect of Johnson's personality, one that would have surprised those who, knowing only the public Lyndon Johnson, the loud Lyndon of the Little Congress and the Dodge Hotel, thought they knew him. There were times when Johnson would stop criticizing their driving or even noticing it. Slouching down in the seat, he would sink into a kind of reverie. "He would get very, very quiet," Latimer says. "His eyes might be pointed at the window, but you could tell he wasn't sitting over there looking at the landscape. He was thinking, planning." Some people in Washington would say, "Oh, Lyndon, he's always talking." But in that car, sometimes he would be quiet for a long time, for hours and hours. He'd never close his eyes, and he'd never say a word. He'd just be thinking. And boy, everyone found out pretty fast not to bother him while he was thinking. He didn't want anyone talking to him while he was thinking, and because it disturbed him, he didn't want anyone talking to anyone else either. As the car roared down the narrow roads to Texas, across the gentle green hills of Virginia, through the winding passes of the Appalachians, down the valley of the Cumberland in Tennessee, and finally onto the flat plains of Texas, across which his forebears had trudged behind wagons, Lyndon Johnson stared unseeing out the window, hour after hour. His two young assistants, bored, in the words of friendly, loquacious little Latimer, "through and through," were afraid to break the silence with a single word. Another aspect of Lyndon Johnson on these 1,600-mile drives would also have surprised those who knew him only in Washington, and who, having been given a short-lived home in his car, felt that the speed with which he drove indicated carelessness or recklessness. Pulling into a gas station, he never failed to check the car, the motor, and, most conspicuously, the tires. "He was always conscious of the tires," Jones says. "He always bought the best tires available, and whenever we would stop, he always, always took the time to check them very, very carefully." Walking around the car, Johnson would kneel on the ground beside each tire, look at its treads, press it to measure the air pressure, test the tightness of each and every bolt holding it on. Back on the road again, Johnson would be driving like a crazy man. Because of his behavior at the service station, however, Jones and Latimer felt that behind the craziness, the frenzied, frantic, almost desperate aggressiveness and haste, lay thorough, painstaking care. And because of the long, intense silences, they believed that behind the haste lay also the most careful, calculating thinking, planning. Those who knew only the public Lyndon Johnson saw the energy and the aggressiveness. Those who knew him best of all, the two youths who for years had not only worked in the same room with him, but slept in the same room with him, saw the preparation, the long, intense, silent, secret preparation, behind the energy and aggressiveness. They did not know its details. Johnson let them know, as he let others know, nothing. But they knew it was taking place. And if the two youths were correct, what exactly was Lyndon Johnson planning? As he sat, hour after hour, staring out at a road without seeing it, what was the road he was seeing? What was the road he was paving, paving with such care? What was the road down which he was traveling, traveling so fast? What led him, already working endless hours a day, 7 days a week, on the affairs of his own district, to add to that crushing load hours on the affairs of other districts, affairs that he could so easily have respectfully referred to others? He never said. His energy and his talent, the talent that was beyond talent and was genius, were at the service of some hidden but vast ambition, and no one knew what it was. Chapter 17. Lady Bird. In the 1932 Democratic primary, in which Richard Clayburgh was challenged for re-election, Clayburgh won 10 of the 11 counties in his district. The one he lost was Lyndon Johnson's home county of Blanco, although in 1931, before Johnson went to work for him, Clayburgh had carried Blanco by a 2-to-1 margin. Some residents of the county felt that he lost Blanco in 1932 because it was Johnson's home. They say that the votes against Clayburgh were an expression of dislike for Clayburgh's secretary. The dislike was to intensify. Even the adoring Latimer, accompanying Johnson on a trip to his hometown 2 years later, noticed it. "He worked hard. He just broke his back to get those people up there to like him," Latimer says. "But they just didn't." Johnson did not return to Johnson City in his own car, or in the car Clayburgh normally put at his disposal. He arrived in the little town in the fanciest car in the Clayburgh fleet, a big, bright yellow Buick with white balloon tires and running W seat covers. He wore his flashiest clothes and a manner to match. "Lyndon came back swaggering around, showing what a big shot he was," says Clayton Stribling. "Same old Lyndon." The same phrase was used at his alma mater. Dazzled though they were by the big Buick, undergraduates who remembered him, and since so many San Marcos students had to interrupt their college careers to earn money, a considerable number of old acquaintances were still around, and who had disliked his swaggering and boastfulness, discerned beneath the dazzle a familiar figure. Loading them into the Buick, he drove them around, pulled out a bottle of whiskey, and, his head tilted back to address those in the back seat, talked incessantly and pompously, largely about the famous men with whom he was now on intimate terms. Barney Knispel, one of those in the back, recalls him saying, and as Knispel imitates Johnson, he adopts a tone of overbearing pomposity, "You know, that's the kind of people you have to associate with," says Horace Richards. "I can still see him in that car, talking, holding sway. Same old Lyndon." One college acquaintance who accompanied him to the King Ranch saw another familiar trait in Johnson, one especially familiar to her. The ultimate power at the ranch resided in its matriarch, 82-year-old Alice Gertrudis King Clayburgh, daughter of its founder and mother of Congressman Clayburgh. Having inherited not only her father's controlling interest in the ranch, but some of his personality as well, she was held in considerable awe. Employees who didn't call her Mrs. Clayburgh never ventured beyond Mrs. Alice. But her son's secretary called her Grandma Clayburgh. He had taken every opportunity to write her from Washington. When he sent her copies of her son's speeches, he always attached a little note. And soon the fierce old woman was writing back. At the ranch, she sat in a big rocker on the long porch. He sat at her feet, his face upturned, listening avidly to her stories about Captain King. He asked her advice on personal matters, told her how much she reminded him of his mother, how much he loved her famous prickly pear jelly. She had inherited from her father an obsession that gates be kept closed to prevent cattle from wandering out of their assigned pastures. One day, after a heavy rainstorm, Johnson drove around the ranch with her. Hooves had churned the ground around each of the many gates through which they passed into deep, sticky mud. Johnson was wearing an expensive blue suit and expensive, highly polished shoes. But at each gate, although there were two booted ranch hands in the car, and at many of the gates cowboys standing around, he made a point of leaping out of the car so that he could be the one to make sure the gate was closed after it passed through. The San Marcos acquaintance who had accompanied them on this drive was not surprised by the scene, as she was not surprised by his overall adoration of Grandma Clayburgh. The acquaintance was Ethel Davis, who, years before, had herself been asked by Lyndon for advice, and had been told of her own resemblance to his mother, and who had concluded, in a phrase now being echoed in Washington, he was a professional son. Another development in Lyndon Johnson's life would have been found familiar at San Marcos, for the belief that he was determined to marry money had been widespread on the campus. Lyndon Johnson had courted two young women. Each, Carol Davis of San Marcos and Kitty Clyde Ross of Johnson City, had been the daughter of the richest man in town. In 1934, he began courting a third young woman. She was Claudia Alta Taylor of Karnak, Texas. Her nickname was Lady Bird, and whether or not, and no one can know, her father's position was the explanation, or any part of the explanation, for Lyndon Johnson's interest in her, her father was the richest man in town. The son of an Alabama sharecropper, Thomas Jefferson Taylor had GTT, to Harrison County in East Texas, an area reminiscent, in the rutted red clay of its low hills, in its fetid swamps and stagnant, muddy bayous lined with the gnarled roots of giant, moss-draped cypresses, and in the servitude in which it kept its Negro sharecroppers, who made up half its population, of the Old South from which he had come. And Thomas Jefferson Taylor might have been typecast as an Old South small-town furnishing merchant. He had opened a truly general store, T.J. Taylor, dealer in everything. And then another, and then a cotton gin, and then another. A tall, 6'2", fat, ham-handed man, loud and coarse, he never talked about anything but making money, and he was tireless in its pursuit. He rose at 4 a.m. to open his stores, and after a long day behind the counter, returned home at sundown to spend a long evening toting up accounts and checking the dates on IOUs. During harvest time, he never left his gins until the last wagon load of cotton had been baled. But even if the baler didn't stop until 1 or 2 a.m., when he went home to his ledgers. Tireless and ruthless, he loaned money to tenants and sharecroppers at 10% interest, and his tactics with those who fell behind in their payments led Gene Lassiter, who grew up near his home, to say, "The Negroes were kept in peonage by Mr. Taylor. He would furnish them with supplies and let them have land to work, then take their land if they didn't pay. When I first saw how he operated, I thought the days of slavery weren't over yet." His own son, Lady Bird's brother, says, "He looked on Negroes pretty much as hewers of wood and drawers of water. White men called him Captain Taylor. Negroes called him Mr. Boss. He bought more land and more, until by the time he married Minnie Lee Patillo of Alabama, he owned 18,000 acres, was Mr. Boss of the whole northern portion of Harrison County, and lived in the county's most imposing residence, the Brick House, a two-story white antebellum structure with columns in front that sat on a red clay hill about a mile outside Karnak, spelled K-A-R-N-A-C-K, a town with about 100 residents that had been named, by someone who couldn't spell, after the temples of Egypt. When Lady Bird, her nickname was given her at the age of 2 by a Negro nurse because she's purty as a ladybird, was born on December 22, 1912, Captain Taylor was still poring over ledgers at night, and Lady Bird's 2 brothers, both much older, were away at school. Aside from Negro playmates, her mother was her only companion. Her mother loved culture. She had come to Karnak with trunkloads of beautifully bound books, and every year went to Chicago for the opera season, and loved to read to her daughter, who loved to listen. "I remember so many things," Lady Bird would say, "all of the Greek and Roman myths, and many of the German myths. Siegfried was the first person I was in love with." But when Lady Bird was 5, her mother died, and the leitmotif of the rest of Lady Bird's childhood, the 16 years until at 21 she met Lyndon Johnson, was loneliness. Her father didn't know what to do with the motherless little girl. For a while he took her with him, letting her play around the store in the daytime. At night she slept on a cot in the attic above the store. Stacked near the cot were long wooden boxes that Taylor sold, coffins. Then, when she was 6, he sent her, a tag around her neck for identification, on a train ride alone. Captain Taylor appears to have been fond of his daughter, but he wouldn't neglect his business. To Alabama, and her mother's spinster sister Effie. Aunt Effie, who soon moved to Karnak, raised Lady Bird. She was a slight, sickly woman. "She opened my spirit to beauty," Lady Bird says, "but she neglected to give me any insight into the practical matters a girl should know about, such as how to dress or choose one's friends, or learning to dance." Nonetheless, her aunt was her closest companion. Her aunt and those beautiful books. The little girl loved to read, memorized poems that she could recite decades later, finished Ben-Hur at the age of 8. "Perhaps I had a lonely childhood," she was to say in her carefully chosen words, "but it didn't seem lonely to me." But she perhaps affords a more revealing glimpse of her life in the brick house when, talking about another town in Texas, she says, "I came from a small town myself, except that I was never part of the town, lived outside." At school, a one-room structure atop a red clay hill, there were seldom as many as a dozen students, and few of them stayed long. Since they were children of tenant farmers who owed money to Captain Taylor, they were constantly moving away. At 13, she moved with Effie into an apartment in Marshall, the county seat, where she went to high school, graduating at 15, but her high school years do not appear to have been happy ones. Although her eyes were expressive and her complexion a smooth olive, she was not a pretty girl, and her clothes seemed almost deliberately chosen to make her less attractive. Although her father would buy her any clothes she wanted, her baggy dresses looked as if they'd been handed down from some older and larger woman. At dances, she was a wallflower. She appears to have been somewhat of an object of ridicule to the other girls, to whom she had, in any event, little to talk about, preoccupied as they were with dresses and dancing and boys. In remembering her, they remembered a shyness so deep that it seems to have been active fear of meeting or talking to people. One schoolmate, Naomi Bell, says, "Bird wasn't accepted into our clique. We couldn't get Claudia to cooperate on anything. She didn't date at all. To get her to go to the graduation banquet, my fiancé took Bird as his date, and I went with another boy. She didn't like to be called Lady Bird, so we'd call her Bird to get her little temper going. My mother would call her Cat. She'd say, 'All right, pull your claws in, Cat.' When she'd get in a crowd, she'd clam up." Her own recollections of high school are perhaps saddest of all. "I don't recommend that to anyone, getting through high school that young. I was still in socks when all the other girls were wearing stockings. And shy, I used to hope that no one would speak to me. There was one boy who used to try to talk to me. He was real nice, and what's more, he was real glamorous, being on the football team. But I never knew what to say, and finally it got so that if I saw him coming, I'd leave the room." She loved nature, the winding bayous of Lake Caddo, the moss hanging around her as she walked along the lake or rowed a boat on it, flowers, drifts of magnolia all through the woods in the spring, and the daffodils in the yard. When the first one bloomed, I'd have a little ceremony, all by myself, and name it the Queen. But she boated and walked mostly alone. Even her good grades brought her dread. She would never forget her fear at realizing that she might finish first or second in her class, and thereby be valedictorian or salutatorian, and have to make a speech at graduation. She prayed that she would finish no higher than third. She prayed, in fact, that if she came in higher, she would get smallpox. She would rather risk the scars than stand up before an audience. She still remembers the exact final grades of the top three students. Emma Boehringer, 95. Maureen Cranson, 94.5. Claudia Taylor, 94. When she graduated, the school newspaper joked that her ambition was to be an old maid. At the University of Texas, to which she transferred after 2 years at a junior college in Dallas, she was still shy, almost as silent and retiring as she had been in high school. But she began to date occasionally, and two of her beaux received glimpses of qualities beneath the quietness. "For a while," says Thomas C. Solomon, "I thought I was the leader." But, he says, he came to realize that this impression was incorrect. "We had been doing what she wanted to do. Even when we went on a picnic, it was she who thought up the idea. This convinced me that it would take a strong man to be the boss. I also knew she would not marry a man who did not have the potentiality of becoming somebody." J. H. Benefield came to realize that the shy, reserved young woman was one of the most determined persons I met in my life, one of the most ambitious and able. She confided in me her wish to excel. Determination and ambition were also beginning to be manifested in other areas of Lady Bird's life. When she received her Bachelor of Arts degree in 1933, her father and aunt expected her to return to Karnak, but she didn't want to, and she took pains to make sure she wouldn't have to. She had studied to be a teacher, a respectable occupation for a southern girl in danger of becoming an old maid, and had graduated with honors with a second-grade teacher's certificate. But she returned to the university for an extra year and received a second degree, in journalism. "Because I thought that people in the press went more places and met more interesting people and had more exciting things happen to them." And because a journalist couldn't be shy, she fought her shyness, forcing herself to become a reporter for the Daily Texan and to ask questions at press conferences, volunteering to be public relations manager of the university's Intramural Sports Association. And she took other measures to ensure that she wouldn't have to go back to Karnak or to be a teacher. She studied shorthand and typing so that she could go into business. She took those courses, she would say years later, so that she would have the tools that can get you inside the door. Then, with a little skill and a great deal of industry, you can go on and take over the business, or else marry the boss. But if Lady Bird Taylor would make such statements later, she made no statements then. The determination and ambition were well concealed. Despite the unlimited charge account her father had opened for her at Neiman Marcus, she still dressed in flat-heeled, sensible shoes, very plain, and in plain dresses, too big, of colors so drab that they seemed deliberately chosen to avoid calling attention to herself. During her years in Austin, her only coat was an old coat of her Aunt Effie's. She was still, as one observer was to put it later, no glamour girl. If her high school classmates remember a plain girl, almost dowdy in appearance, her college classmates remember a plain young woman. And her battle against shyness sometimes seemed to be a losing one. She had acquired a friend, Emma Boehringer's older sister, Eugenia. "Jean made me feel important for the first time," Lady Bird says. "She was one of those tremendously outgoing people who made everyone around her feel a little more alive. I am a friendlier, more confident person today because of Jean." But Jean herself didn't observe much, if any, confidence in her friend. As for Lady Bird's appearance, after attempting in vain to get her to buy more attractive clothes, Jean called her in exasperation stingy. Jean worked for C.V. Terrell, who, as chairman of the Texas Railroad Commission, was bus inspector Sam Johnson's boss, and Sam had introduced the vivacious, pretty young woman to his son Lyndon. She had turned down his request for a date, but they stayed friends. And in September 1934, passing through Austin on his way to Washington from Corpus Christi, Johnson telephoned Jean and asked her to get him a blind date. And she did, with Dorothy McElroy, who also worked in Terrell's office. Lady Bird dropped by to talk to Jean that afternoon, and when Johnson arrived to pick up Dorothy, she was there. Lyndon already knew, through Jean, who Lady Bird was. He quietly asked her to meet him for breakfast the next morning in the coffee shop of the Driscoll Hotel. She says she didn't plan to, but she was in Austin to consult with an architect about remodeling the brick house. The architect's office was next to the Driscoll, and as she passed the coffee shop, she saw Lyndon sitting at a table at its window. As he realized she wasn't planning to join him, he frantically waved at her until she did. Then he took her for a drive. On it, he first showered her with questions. I never heard so many questions. He really wanted to find out all about me. And then, this man whose mind could follow another mind around and get there before it did, with answers, 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 as she put it, to questions that hadn't been asked. He told me all sorts of things I thought were extraordinarily direct for a first conversation. About his ambitions, how he was determined to become somebody, and was already well on his way as secretary to a congressman who was, moreover, a Clayburg. About his salary, how much insurance he had, his family. It was just as if he was ready to give me a picture of his life and what he might be capable of doing. And then, on this, their first date, he asked her to marry him. I thought it was some kind of joke, she recalls. But she was impressed. He was excessively thin, but very, very good-looking, with lots of black wavy hair, and the most outspoken, straightforward, determined manner I had ever encountered. And he was insistent. The next day he took her to meet his parents, and spoke as though she were already in the family. Bird's eyes were sharp. Describing her first meeting with Lyndon's father, she said, I felt sorry for him. It was obvious that he had been a vigorous, roaring personality once. Now he had a job, a poor-paying one, only because someone remembered him from back when. Asked if she felt any competitiveness between father and son, she said, I felt the competitiveness had existed, once, but no longer. By the time she met Sam Johnson, she says, he was an old and ill man, old and ill before his time. As for Lyndon's mother, as soon as you met them, you were aware that she was a lady. It was obvious that Lyndon just loved her greatly, and I felt drawn to her, and yet I felt like patting her on the shoulder and saying I wasn't going to harm the son on whom she had pinned so many hopes. I just felt like saying, don't you worry. I had no intention at that time of getting married. Bird also says that the house was extremely modest. It was obvious that she had done what she could to make it prettier, had bought some furniture and nice bedspreads, but it was extremely modest. Lyndon knew it, and knew I knew it, and was kind of watching me look at it. But he was intensely proud of his family. He took her to the King Ranch, and she was very impressed by that feudal empire, telling her friends later that it was so big that the Claybergs and their retainers used compasses the way other men used watches. And Grandma Clayburg took her aside and, in her gruff way, told her that Lyndon was a fine young man and that she should marry him. When, a week after they had met, he had to leave for Washington, she invited him and his traveling companion, Malcolm Bardwell, Maury Maverick's secretary, to stop over for a night at the brick house, which was on the way. Edgy over the impression he would make, Johnson exploded with embarrassment the morning after they arrived when Bardwell appeared downstairs in his pajamas. He told me, I'm going to marry this girl. You're going to ruin my marriage if you run around this way. But the man whose opinions counted in the brick house was not one to be put off by déshabille. Ruth Taylor, whom Captain Taylor was to marry not long thereafter, says that, My husband liked Lyndon from the first. Both were much alike. Both were big men physically. Both were work-minded and always in a hurry. Says Lady Bird, I could tell that Daddy was right impressed with him. After dinner, he said in a quiet moment, Daughter, you've been bringing home a lot of boys. This time you brought a man. Before Lyndon drove off for Washington, he asked her to marry him, and again she demurred, but kissed him before they parted, which led a scandalized neighbor to shout at Johnson, Don't do that! Hurry up, go on, or the Ku Klux Klan will get you. Bird was shortly to tell a friend, I have never felt this way before. Describing her feelings, she says, I knew I had met something remarkable, but I didn't know quite what. I had a queer sort of moth and flame feeling. After Johnson arrived back in Washington, Latimer and Jones received what they regarded as the surest possible sign that his intentions were serious. His morning routine had always been inflexible. He always had this invariable rhythm, which nothing had ever been permitted to interrupt, Latimer says. First he would do the mail, then go in the bathroom and go through the newspapers and dictate to L.E. Now, however, after he did the mail, he would not go into the bathroom but into Clayburgh's private office, shutting the door behind him and sitting down to compose a daily letter to this young woman with the funny nickname, whom he had met down in Austin. Latimer, who was to work for Johnson so long, says that during the early years of his career, that was the only time he ever got out of that rhythm, that one time getting off that letter to Bird, the one and only time. He took a lot of care with those letters. Finishing a draft, he would summon Latimer, the brilliant letter writer, for corrections. Asking about the spelling and should there be a comma or was that a dangling participle, he said, you know, Bird's got a journalism degree. He was as insistent on a fast decision in his letters as in person. He assured her of his ambition. My dear Bird, this morning I'm ambitious, proud, energetic, and very madly in love with you. I want to see people, want to walk through the throngs, want to do things with a drive, and pressed her for an affirmative response to his suit. I see something I know I want. I immediately exert efforts to get it. I do or I don't, but I try and do my best. You see something you might want, you tear it to pieces in an effort to determine if you should want it, then you conclude that maybe the desire isn't an everlasting one and that the sane thing to do is to wait a year or so. He assured her of his interest in the cultural matters so important to her. Every interesting place I see, I make a mental reservation and tell myself that I shall take you there when you are mine. I want to go through the museum, the Congressional Library, the Smithsonian, the Civil War battlefields, and all of those most interesting places. Impressed. Why must we wait 12 long months to begin to do the things we want to do forever and ever? And she responded, writing of the interests she evidently had been led to believe they would share. Dearest, I've been reading Early Autumn by Lewis Bromfield, and am enthralled. If we were together, I'd read it to you. There's nothing I'd like better than being comfortable in a nice, cozy place and reading something amusing or well-written or interesting to someone I like. All good things are better shared, aren't they? He was also telephoning her almost daily, and early in November, she recalls, when we were on the phone from Washington, we decided he would come down and we would decide if we would get engaged. The next day, to her shock, the Ford Roadster pulled up the rutted driveway. He had driven from Washington to Karnak without stopping, and had gotten to my father's at least 24 hours before I was expecting it. I hadn't gotten the house quite ready, and I hadn't been to the beauty parlor. No sooner had he arrived than he began arguing, in her words. Let's go on and get married, not next year, but about 2 weeks from now, a month from now, or right away. She agreed to let him buy her an engagement ring. They drove together the 300 miles to Austin to pick one out together. But when, in the jewelry store, he proposed buying a matching wedding ring, she refused to allow him to do so. She wouldn't make any decision without going to Alabama and talking to Aunt Effie. She had concentrated all her life and all her love on me, and I just knew that I had to go and see her. She took the trip while Lyndon drove to Corpus Christi, and her aunt was appalled that Bird would even consider marrying a man she had known less than 2 months. But when she returned to Karnak, there in the driveway of the brick house was the Ford Roadster, and when she reported Effie's reaction, her father said, "If you wait until Aunt Effie is ready, you will never marry anyone," and added, "Some of the best deals are made in a hurry." She said she wanted to ask Jean Boehringer's advice, but Lyndon insisted on accompanying her to Austin, and hardly had they started driving when he issued an ultimatum. "We either get married now or we never will. and if you say goodbye to me, it just proves to me that you just don't love me enough to dare to. And I just can't bear to go on and keep wondering if it will ever happen." When she agreed to get married at once, she says, he let out a Texas yip that she was sure could be heard in the next county. The engagement lasted as long as it took to drive from Karnak to San Antonio. Worried about making arrangements on such short notice, Lyndon called Dan Quill, whose influence in City Hall procured an immediate marriage license, and who then argued a reluctant Episcopalian minister, who said at first that to marry two people he had never met on such short notice would be a justice of the peace ceremony, into making an exception in this case. Johnson was to recall that as he and Lady Bird walked into St. Mark's Episcopal Church, he was still persuading Lady Bird that she was doing the right thing. And when, during the simple ceremony attended only by Quill, a lawyer acquaintance and a hastily summoned friend of Lady Bird's, it came time to place a ring on the bride's finger, Johnson had still not bought one, and Quill dashed across the street to a Sears Roebuck store and brought back a tray of inexpensive wedding bands. The one she chose cost $250. To complete the ceremony. After a wedding supper at St. Anthony's Hotel, at which, because none of the guests had sufficient funds to purchase a bottle of the hotel's high-priced wines, the wedding toast was drunk after the lawyer rushed home to get a bottle of his own, Lyndon and Lady Bird drove to the Plaza Hotel, where they spent their wedding night. The next morning, Lady Bird telephoned Jean Boehringer, who had been expecting her in Austin, and told her surprised friend, Lyndon and I committed matrimony last night. Lyndon telephoned his mother, who would hope that when her son got married, she would be invited to the wedding. The tone of the letters that Lyndon Johnson wrote to Lady Bird before he married her was not the tone that others heard him using to her immediately after they were married. The morning after the ceremony, heading for a brief honeymoon in Mexico, they stopped at the little town of Cal Allen, near Corpus Christi, to say hello to William P. Elliott, a reporter for the Corpus Christi Caller, and his wife Mary, as they sat chatting in the living room. Johnson said, in Mrs. Elliott's recollection, "You've got to change your stockings, Bird. You've got to run." Embarrassed, Bird did not immediately obey, and Mrs. Elliott remembers he ordered her to. Just ordered her, right in front of us. Back in Washington, where, after a few days in an upstairs room at the Dodge, they moved into a furnished one-bedroom apartment at 1910 Calorama Road, the tone was similarly one of command. It was, in fact, little different from the tone in which he addressed Latimer and Jones. Acquaintances who heard it were shocked. If he disapproved of the clothes his bride was wearing, he would tell her so, in a voice harsh with contempt, regardless of whether others were present. Across a crowded room, at a Texas State Society party, for example, he shouted orders at her, and the orders had to be instantly obeyed. "Lady Bird, go get me another piece of pie." "I will in just a minute, Lyndon." "Get me another piece of pie." Wingate Lucas says, "He'd embarrass her in public, just yell at her across the room, tell her to do something. All the people from Texas felt very sorry for Lady Bird." Seeing her shyness, her almost visible terror at having attention called to herself, acquaintances were soon making a remark that would be repeated for decades by acquaintances of the Johnsons. "I don't know how she stands it." This book is continued on cassette number 4, side 1.